Michael Franczak went to Afghanistan as a Marine jet fighter pilot in 2002. His squadron, known as the Flying Nightmares, flew ground cover during Operation Enduring Freedom. Franczak was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross in 2005. He packed it in a trunk, along with three journals he'd kept, which now form the foundation of his new memoir, A Nightmare's Prayer. He joins us from the studio of member station WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on your show.
You flew 117 combat missions. You write with such detail. It feels like we're in the cockpit with you. I kept getting images of, you know, the Star Wars movie where the jets would go into the Death Star and then come out. Well, your Death Star happened to be the mountain range in Afghanistan and the weather. There were a lot of snafus, I think is probably the best way to
sure.
put it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it had to do with the jet that you were flying, the AV-8B, the Harrier. Why is it called the Widowmaker?
It's called the Widowmaker because it killed a lot of Marines, and some of them, I lost a lot of friends flying that airplane. During my flying career, flying the Harrier from 1990 to 2006, 16 years, the Harrier had an accident rate that was three times as high as the other Marine Corps' airplane, which was a F-18 Hornet. So you were three times as likely to die or be in a major accident flying a Harrier than you were a Hornet.
Are Harriers still being used, and what was it that made them so dangerous?
Well, Harriers are still being used in the fight over in Afghanistan. The Harrier is a dangerous aircraft to fly because it's very unforgiving, and the airplane has had some mechanical issues throughout its history. The engine has been unreliable over time, and when you have one engine and it's unreliable, that sometimes isn't a good thing.
Was there any time where you really hesitated to pull that trigger?
Well, I pulled it several times, and I think the first time that before I pulled it, there was a millionth of a second hesitation. Before I had seen death so much over there, heard it, supported the guys. We chased the enemy. They escaped back to Pakistan, can't get them. And you know, I was sad and I was sick about that. And that's what brought along a lot of the anger of just being frustrated after 8 months and not being able to get the enemy. So in this one incident, when I come in and it's that first time and all of a sudden the fact tells me, you're cleared hot on that target, I realize that when I pull the trigger, death is 1 second away and it's going to come from me. And I just thought, what do I do? But right away, I knew the answer. The answer is training takes over and you pull the trigger.
Yeah.
And there was no question and afterwards, and I had no remorse whatsoever about what I did.
What does it feel like now, given that you flew Harrier missions? What do you think of the use of drones in the war now?
I support it. I think that we need to be able to go after and attack the enemy. That said, I certainly believe that the war is not going to be won by air and by predators. A predator or a drone doesn't sit down and have tea with the local head honcho. He doesn't shake hands with the school children. He doesn't find out the projects that the local community needs. We need people on the ground that are going to be able to do that. I believe confidently that if the war is to be won, first of all, it's going to have to be won by Afghanistan itself, deciding that it's going to stick with it. But it's going to be won by boots on the ground.
Pilots are known for being
egotistical.
And, you know, like to do.
Sure.
You did something interesting. You would occasionally lift up your night vision goggles while you were flying missions, you know, with mountains on either side of you. I mean, what were you thinking?
Oh, I was thinking about getting a thrill. I would peek under them.
Uh-huh.
So I would be down in the valley, bustering along at 500 knots over 550 miles an hour, and I'd probably be about 500 feet above the ground. The minimum altitude was much higher than that. It was 10,000 feet. We weren't supposed to go below. But there were times that we got tasked with missions of going down and making a lot of noise so that it appeared something was going to happen. And this was one of those nights that I was running down the Pech River Valley. So I'm running down the valley, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and there's a full moon, and you got mountain peaks on both sides. And I knew, you know, a friend of mine had turned me on this trick that when you peek under the goggles, you can't see anything. And, of course, you're going 500-plus miles an hour, and just a flinch of the stick, you're going to hit the ground. So it was always just a thrill just to peek up and go, man, I can't see anything there.
What are you doing now?
I'm a contract pilot, and I go to places like Afghanistan. The nice thing is, instead of flying bombs, I fly ice cream and parts and people around. It's not as exciting, but I kind of like that.
Michael Franczak is a retired Marine Harrier pilot. His new memoir about the war in Afghanistan is called A Nightmare's Prayer. He joined us from member station WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on your show.
You're listening to NPR News. Runners in the Polar Circle Marathon who want to calculate their endurance may have to tweak the math because of one important factor: the cold. The event, which took place yesterday, is held each year in Greenland, just north of the polar circle. It's billed as the coolest marathon on Earth, and runners pass through 26 miles of ice, snow, and exceptionally brisk temperatures. Yesterday's high was 19 degrees Fahrenheit. Last year's top female competitor in the Polar Circle Marathon was Mariana Del Comin, and she joins us from her home outside Copenhagen, Denmark. Welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot.
Some of the guidelines on the race website include bringing spiky boots to put over your running shoes, keep an eye out for reindeer, and avoid falling through the crevasses that often line the route. What is it like to run a race in that environment?
It was a huge, huge challenge. You just have to be there to experience this huge, wide landscape, covered in snow and ice and beautiful mountains, and it's just stunning.
Wow. What do you wear in a marathon like this?
Well, on our race day last year, it was only about minus 10, and it wasn't windy at all, so it wasn't too bad. So I was wearing just normal winter running gear, tights and a few tops, and then a jacket, gloves, and a beanie. And that was actually about it. During the race, you get warm soup, and you can change gear during the race and adjust if you're too cold or too warm.
So what is it that motivates a marathoner to actually do this kind of race in a cold, remote location? I mean, what, are city marathons a lot less interesting or something?
No, but I did New York once, which was amazing. But it's just like after doing 10 city marathons, I was just thinking, well, next challenge would be running in the cold. And then living in Greenland for a year, it was just obvious for me to go down there and take that challenge.
You took a year off, but will you return next year?
Yes, I hope so. I really hope so. I would have loved to go this year, but I couldn't. And even though I won the race last year and I made a race record, I'm a very competitive person, and I'm sure I can do better than I did last year. So just to do it again, because it was just so beautiful. It's the best race ever.
Mariana Del Comin is the 2009 female champion of the Polar Circle Marathon, which was run yesterday. She joined us from her home near Copenhagen, Denmark. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. In Haiti, an outbreak of cholera has begun to claim more victims. There are now more than 200 confirmed dead and more than 2,700 sick. The disease has also begun to edge closer to the crowded refugee camps in the capital, Port-au-Prince. Melody Munns is Environmental Health Program Coordinator with the International Rescue Committee. We've reached her in Port-au-Prince. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
The outbreak began in the rural area to the north of Port-au-Prince, but it now appears to be spreading. If it reaches the refugee camps in the capital, what do you fear could happen?
Well, our greatest fear is that it will spread very, very rapidly through the camps. It could be very difficult to contain. The main reason for that is that the camps are generally very, very crowded, and we're also sitting in the middle of the rainy season and the hurricane season. So a lot of the camps are prone to flooding, which is a very good transmission route for any diseases, particularly diarrheal diseases.
What are the main things the IRC is doing to fight the spread?
The principal thing is we're part of a coordinated humanitarian response here to have a systematic treatment of all water sources in all regions, both at the source, so at, in a lot of cases we're trucking water, also there's well water. So we're treating at the source, and as well we're also providing water treatment chemicals for people to treat at the household level. That's the first thing. Then we're also doing a mass distribution of soap and we're stepping up our hygiene promotion activities, making sure that they're drinking the safest possible water they can, and especially washing their hands. Mm. Hand washing is number one.
Are there enough supplies?
For the moment, there are sufficient supplies if it doesn't spread too quickly. Most of the humanitarian organizations have pre-positioned materials that we can begin a response with, but we will need to mobilize additional water treatment supplies, medical supplies for rehydration, antibiotics for treatment, and we have to make sure that the water supply is going to be adequate and adequately treated.
How difficult is it to get the supplies to the people who need it quickly enough?
Well, because of the earthquake in January, a lot of systems were set in motion to provide water and sanitation to all of the camps. It's really just a matter of maintaining those programs that are already in place and making sure that the water supplies are adequately chlorinated and the cleaning materials and soaps are continuously distributed to the camps.
For the people who have already contracted cholera, you mentioned antibiotics. Is that the way you treat it?
Well, yes and no. The first step is as soon as somebody realizes that they have any symptoms of diarrhea at all, the first thing to do is begin rehydration. When cholera strikes, it actually sucks all of the as much as possible the liquids from the body, and people lose all their electrolytes, potassiums, and salts. So we need to replace that as quickly as possible so that the organs of the body don't shut down. Mm-hmm. Cholera is eminently treatable if people rehydrate immediately and seek care.
Do you think this is going to be protracted, or this could be over quickly?
It's very difficult to say. What I can say is the International Rescue Committee and all of the other humanitarian organizations that are working in this area, we are well prepared. Cholera treatment centers are going up as we speak, and the preparations to respond to it, if and when it does hit Port-au-Prince, are all mobilized now.
Melody Muntz is with the International Rescue Committee. We reached her in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Thank you. Good luck.
Thank you very much.